ROI on me investing in myself is usually 10x. So when I invested, which was 40K last week, I know in the next year, if I do the work, that'll be close to $500,000 in terms of a return, if not more. And I think that's what we got to look for. Back yourself, find the right coach for you. Take your time, don't be impulsive, do a bit of research, ask for some testimonials and case studies, but please invest in yourself. It's so crucial.
Welcome to another episode of Success for the Athletic Minded Man. Real talk on harnessing your athletic drive for clarity, consistency, and focus in business and life. This is your host, Jim Harshaw Jr., and today I bring you James Lachlan. James Lachlan is a high performance coach. And listen, I know we talk about high performance habits and high performing teams and individuals. We've talked about that a lot over the years. This is a really fascinating conversation you're about to hear. Just a really enjoyable conversation, fascinating conversation. And we go a couple little different directions that you might not expect. And this is a guy, he's actually coaching, he shares on the show here, he's actually coaching the leader of a country, a world leader. And you get access to him, and he offers a free download towards the end of the show as well that you can check out. And he talks about working with the All Blacks, and he talks about just a lot of different things that are a really unique, powerful take on being a high performer and what it takes to be at your best. So really fun conversation for me. Share this with a friend. That's how these things grow. That's how a podcast grows, right? Really, when you share it with a friend, if you see it on social media, give it a share, give it a comment, give it a like, and the algorithm boosts it there as well. So thank you in advance for that. And here we go. Let's get into my interview with James Lachlan. You've been alcohol free for 5 years. Tell me about that. What's that journey? Why did you decide to go alcohol free? I'm just curious to start there.
It's kind of weird talking to an Irishman who doesn't drink, right? So I grew up in Northern Ireland and was drinking from about the age of 13, 14. Even at lunchtime, sometimes me and my friends would be in our school uniforms at the pub having a pint and a pie. Not cool, but that's what we were doing. I then carried that on into my adult life. It was how I socialized. It's how I relaxed. And look, I think like most people, I would say, like, I wasn't an alcoholic, but I was drinking 4 or 5, maybe in 6 days a week. It could have been ranging from 1 beer to 5 beers to a bottle of wine to, on the weekend, it could have been, 10 units of alcohol, more than I should be having. So I got to early 30s and my partner Caroline said, look, I'm going to do 1 year no beer. I laughed. I said, that sounds terrible. Why would you do such a thing? And like, all of our lives and entertaining clients all revolves around alcohol, having a couple of cheeky drinks. And I said, I think I'd struggle to do that. So I slept on it, woke up the next day. I thought, well, that was a justification. I justified why I need to have alcohol really quickly. And I said to myself, but I've done, dry July. I can do 30 days, so I don't really need to do a year. And then I thought, nah, I want to navigate a birthday. I want to navigate a New Year's. I want to navigate a big milestone. I want to navigate some tough stuff. Can I do all of that without going, let's have a drink? And so, yeah, I committed to 1 year no alcohol with Caroline. We got to the 1 year mark and went out to celebrate with a bottle of champagne was the plan. Go out and get some bubbles. And the waiter came and said, what would you like? We looked at each other and we'll have a zero beer, thanks. And it's just year after year after year. We're 5.5 years in. And Jim, my life has changed significantly. My business has changed significantly. My ability to be a better dad. Like, I just feel I'm a better human with no alcohol. That's just honest truth.
Yeah. I mean, I found myself drinking less and less alcohol over the years, significantly less. And I've gotten addicted to the feeling of feeling good. And, you and I both interviewed James Swanwick, who, promotes just going alcohol free. And this is not for people who are alcoholics or have trouble with alcohol or whatever. This is just about living a high performance life, right? You wrote a book called The Habits of High Performers. Is this a theme that you see? I mean, would you consider this a habit of high performers?
Absolutely. Many of the men and CEOs that I work with, the one thing that they talk about is, oh God, I wish I could drink a bit less. Like I have to do it because I'm entertaining, or the big party's coming up. It's my mate's 50th and God, I got to drink. And I think it's one thing a lot of people want to do, but they struggle to actually embed it in their lives. And there's a sense of like leaving the tribe, like, my God, you're leaving the drinking tribe. So you're going to be,
an outcast.
100%. But I think give it a crack. And it's not for everyone, but give it a crack. Try a year. A year's a commitment. But I hang out with lots of people who drink. It's not like I don't like drinkers, but I just think you get a lot more done. Think of it this way. If you're hungover once a week Let's say you just have 4 or 5 drinks and the next day you're a bit under power. Well, if we take that once a week, there's 52 weeks. There's 52 days of subpar performance, subpar being a dad, subpar being a partner, whatever it might be. 52 days, that's 2 months of mediocrity. And so I always say to my clients, are you willing to be mediocre for 2 months of the year? And they always go, hell no. Like I said, it's a definite no. And that's drinking once a week to the point where you're a little bit dusty the next day.
Yeah. Yeah. So that is kind of the opposite of what you preach and you live, right? You're really about high performance and building high performing teams and high performing individuals. You have experience as a high performer yourself, you know, world champion in drumming, and you have worked with the All Blacks and just, you know, you've had some amazing people on your podcast, and you work with world-class athletes and business men and women. So what do most people get wrong? What are some assumptions that people have about high performers that might be counterintuitive, or do you think that people get wrong?
Two things. So one, people think that high performance is a birthright. You know, you were born that way. The Usain Bolt was born that way. No, he wasn't. Like, the discipline that guy had was phenomenal. Now, the second thing is people believe high performance is only achievable if you hustle. I am anti-hustle. For years, I listened to Gary Vee and thought he was a legend. And hey, he really is in a lot of ways. But I do not love this idea of hustle, grind, work harder, do the 55-hour week. No, like, chill out. I believe high performance is achieved through habits. And you can do your 30-hour week or your 40-hour week. You can have your hobbies, your family, your well-being. The high performers I work with, it's all about how do we achieve on-field and off-field success.
So what would you say are some of the habits of high performers? You wrote the book, and I mean, what are the things that you've seen over the years that are common themes of high performers?
People knowing what they actually want. Getting radically clear on what success looks like. I had a young guy come to me and say, James, would you be my coach? It's like, yeah, I could be. How can I help you? He says, I just want you to help me be the greatest. I was like, okay, I'll see you next week. So he rocks up and I says, hey, what do you want? And he starts with, I says, cool, I'll see you next week. And he goes, what? I says, I'll see you next week. He says, James, I've paid you for an hour. It's my first session and you're telling me to leave. I'm like, yeah, see you next week. He says, I don't know what you mean. I was like, well, you don't know what you want, and I can't help you. I'll give you a full refund. See you next week. So he comes back next week. What do you want? And he goes, I want to be the greatest All Black rugby player of all time. Okay, cool. This is good. Why do you want it so badly? Well, I want to make my grandfather proud. He was in the All Blacks. Okay, awesome. How much are you willing to suffer to actually achieve that outcome? And we explored what suffering would look like. And I said, now I can be your coach because you know what you want, you know why you want it, and you've described to me what you're willing to sacrifice or suffer to actually achieve it. So I'd say that's something we all struggle with, but we all need to get radically clear on.
Yeah, radical clarity. I love that.
Quick interruption. Hey, if you like what you're hearing, be sure to get the notes, quotes, and links in the action plan from this episode. Just go to jimharshawjr.com/action. That's jimharshawjr.com/action to get your free copy of the action plan. Now back to the show.
My longtime listeners will know that I have a concept that I've identified over the years that just seems to be a habit of high performers. I'm curious on your take on this, James. So I've so often asked some form of the question, you know, what's one habit you most credit for your success? And often people are talking about, you know, I work with a coach, or I have a journaling habit, or once a year I do a retreat and kind of review my year, or maybe it's even just like in the beginning of the day, I sit down and I write down on a notebook, on a piece of paper, what are the three things I got to do to win the day? So it's never doing the thing, but it's always this version of stepping back, hitting the pause button, getting radical clarity, whether it's on the next hour that what have I got to get out of this meeting, or the next year, what am I trying to accomplish in the next year, or even bigger, right? What do I want out of my life? And so I coined the term productive pause. And the definition is it's a short period of focused reflection around specific questions that leads to clarity of action and peace of mind. And that hits right home to what you said, radical clarity. And
So how does somebody go about getting radical clarity? I mean, you don't get it by just going, let me just show up and on a call with James and try to figure it out. Like, that's why you sent him away. Like, go figure it out. Like how do you help people get clarity?
Yeah, it's an absolute practice. You know, working with the leader of a country right now, and he read the book and said, James, I want more of that. I want to be able to lead the country whilst thriving at home with my well-being, my relationships. I said, okay, great. Show me your calendar. So gets his calendar out and shares me. I says, meeting, 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 speech, parliament, parliament, meeting. Where's lunch? Oh, just, if I can, I'll grab something on the run. Where's think time? And he says, excuse me? I said, where's your daily think time? Well, what's that? I was like, that's just a 30-minute block that's non-negotiable. It's like the president of the USA saying, I want a meeting with you. Would you skip that? Oh, no, I'd be there for that. I was like, cool. Your think time needs to be as important as that. And it's non-negotiable. Well, what do I do during that? It's like, you switch your phone off. You have no podcast on. You have no people around you. Your emails are way out of the way. And you have a notebook, an old school journal. And in there, you ask some powerful questions. You know, what's gone well today? What's not gone so well this month? What am I learning right now? What most needs my attention? So we have four or five questions, like power questions that we ask. And just reflect on those every single day. So it's, people go, James, that's such common sense. But it's not always common practice, right?
Yeah. Easy to do, easy not to do.
Yeah, there you go. I like that saying.
Yeah, most people understand that they need to hit the pause button. They need to get clarity, but they don't know how to do it. And it's hard, be honest, it's hard to do by yourself, right? It is not easy to do without somebody like you, somebody like me, who's, you know, on the outside of the jar, like we're on the inside of the jar trying to read the label. We need that person on the outside who can see the things that we can't see. So you're working with a leader of a country. What's that like?
To start with, I was a bit shocked that when he approached me. I thought, what the, like, how does this come about? How can I help? You know, you're running the country. But when I started realizing what his challenges were, I'm like, yeah, I can help you with that. You're just the same as you and I. You know, he puts his trousers on the same way that you and I do. He has ambitions, challenges, goals. And so, yeah, it's quite fascinating. His problems and potential risks are significantly larger than most. And the media scrutiny, obviously, most of us wouldn't face as much as he would. But I find it a great challenge. I like being outside my comfort zone.
Yeah, yeah. So regular guy when you get to know him. But I find that with a lot of the people I work with and people I know, and I'm, you know, friends who have won Olympic gold medals, like regular people, but also there's something different about them too, right? So what do you find different about, say, the world leader or you know, a member of the All Blacks? What are the things that you see that are different in those individuals?
Honestly, there's two things for me: radical obsession being the first, and hunger being the second. So radically obsessed about an outcome, radically obsessed about a transformation. You know, this guy up behind me on the wall, for those that are watching this, not listening, is Nelson Mandela. Why is he up there? I see him as being the ultimate in transformation. He went from arguably being a terrorist in his early years and was, you know, committing treason to being what most might call a saint, a worldly saint who transformed an entire nation and arguably the world. So I spent 20 years spending time with his grandson, with his private secretary, with people that he influenced. Go, how did he do it? He was radically obsessed with equality, with justice. That was his thing. And so these people that I work with, whether they're everyday humans, whether they are running countries, companies, or they're athletes, the ones who do the best are radically obsessed. They don't look at the shiny objects. So that's the first one for sure. When I share that with you, does that resonate with some of the people that you've connected with or work with?
Yeah, absolutely. They have like a single-minded focus. They're very focused on something. And, you know, when they fail or have a setback, they just tend to keep on going. They're very resilient. And I think that that also comes from radical clarity, right? If you have radical clarity, like Nelson Mandela did, when you have that radical clarity, like you just move forward in a way that is different than you would if you were kind of clear.
100%. It gives you, it removes all the noise, all the distractions, and gives you a very clear path. Like, there's my path. Allows you to say no much easier. The second thing, Jim, was hunger. Hunger. And it's like, people talk to me about motivation. One of the habits in the book is multiply your motivation. And I prefer the word desire, but I know that people don't connect with that. So in the book, I use motivation, but as soon as you start reading, you're like, ah, we're going for something deeper here. Motivation's like Tony Robbins in your ears on a Monday morning to get you started. If you rely on that, it's not sustainable. There's going to be burnout. You need to manage your own desire. So I find that people who truly get after what's most important, they have massive levels of hunger, and it's intrinsic. It's not money, status, power, fame. It's none of that stuff, because that stuff comes with major trappings. I had a billionaire client 2 years ago, and amazing guy, done phenomenal things. And he's on his fifth divorce. And so we're chatting to him about that. And he goes, ah, it's only $200 million it's costing me this one, but just giving her a dollar pisses me off. And I just paused with him and I said, dude, are you happy? He went, I've never thought about that. And he's clearly not a happy man. I says, look, it's all about money and status and winning and power. And have you thought about what makes you tick? What brings the joy? What makes you deeply present? That doesn't involve flash cars, private jets, and winning everything. And he's like, no. So I said, well, let's work on the intrinsic. And that's often where our hunger comes from. It's the things that intrinsically drive us that we do because we feel like we're making a difference, because we're passionate about it, because we have fun doing it. So Nelson Mandela, intrinsic drive to make a difference in his country, for the next door neighbor who is going through apartheid, for his grandmother who'd been beat up, you know, in this apartheid, in a war, essentially. Intrinsic. It wasn't about him becoming prime minister or president. It was none of that. It was all about making a difference. So get hungry about what you want to achieve.
And it sounds like this is often about turning the focus outward to others, right? When it's us, you know, I've seen this in my own life, in athletics and in business. Like when the focus is on me, you know, me winning, me growing my business, I get stuck in the details. I get self-conscious. My ego gets in the way, and even pressure grows. But when I turn the focus outward, right? When I was competing as a wrestler, it was, you know, just turning my focus outward, being the best version of myself, just pursuing excellence, and the same thing in my business. Like the pressure goes away, things become more fun. You get creative and you find ways through, over, around, under obstacles that you just don't see whenever you're inwardly focused and focused on me and ego and the flashy cars and the money and all that.
100%. It's really interesting. I feel like passion is for you and purpose is for others. And often we're doing the opposite thing. What's your purpose? Find your purpose. It's like, well, no, your purpose is you doing things or something for other people's benefit. That's what purpose is. Otherwise, it's just passion. If you're finding, you know, like kite surfing, that's a passion. You know, if you want to build a business, great. That's, you're passionate about it, but what's the purpose behind it? Who else is benefiting? So that's how I often look at things, is passion versus purpose.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great distinction. You've said that high performance is tied to hormones. Unpack that for me.
Yeah, it's interesting. So we can get really clear on our goals and have SMART goals and roadmaps and blueprints for our year ahead. That's awesome. We need that. However, if your neurotransmitters, your hormones, are not set up to support you, good luck. So when we look at, let's take a rat. So a rat that's starving, and you put food in front of it, it will move forward and eat it very quickly. However, if that starving rat has its dopamine receptor blocked, it will have the food put literally a centimeter in front of its nose, its favorite food, and it's starving, and it won't move towards it at all. Zero motivation to move. And so we're no different. So if our norepinephrine or noradrenaline, our endorphins, dopamine, serotonin, if those four things, which are really our key neurotransmitters, if they aren't firing, if they aren't balanced well, we're not going to be motivated to get after our goals. It's like the person who says, I'm going to go to F45, I'm going to go to the gym. 6 weeks later, they got the membership. It's a year-long membership and they're no longer going. Often it comes down to what's happening underneath the hood. And so managing those neurotransmitters is crucial. You know, men 35 plus, we know that their cortisol levels are high because their testosterone levels are dropping. And so how do we actually manage that? Well, let's face it. If you've got low testosterone, you're less driven. If you've got low testosterone, you know that little belly you're struggling to get rid of, even though you're crushing it at the gym and you're doing the long cycles, it's not moving. Testosterone and cortisol have a big part to play in that. So I was chatting with one of the world's leading longevity experts, and he was saying, James, meditation and the research on it has shown if you meditate twice a day, 5 to 10 minutes, it balances those neurotransmitters to the point where testosterone starts to rebalance quite naturally. So there's certain things we can do to become more successful that don't involve hustle and hard work and crushing it at the gym. Often it's actually the opposite. How do I take the stress out, take the cortisol down, increase my testosterone?
Yeah, interesting. So a friend of mine, Dean Slider, he's a meditation expert. I have had him on the podcast, and he actually came to my client retreat this past year. He uses the term around meditation about, he says, shutting down the engines, right? Shutting down the engines, like letting the engines cool down. And that really resonated with me because me, myself, and like a lot of my clients, like we run hot, right? We're pushing, we're driven, we're going. And it's like, what do you mean stop? Like I'm going, like I gotta go, you know? And that pause, like we talked about earlier, right? Pause, reflect. And then this is a different kind of pause where you're just pausing and not reflecting. You're shutting down the engine. You're letting your brain just settle and cool. And then whenever you fire it back up, it operates better.
It really does. It's interesting. At the minute, this last couple of months with the book launch and lots of travel, my stress levels have been elevated a bit. And so my sleep score has been somewhere between like 70 to 80 at most, sometimes in the 60s. Last night, I did about a 45-minute meditation before dinner. Then came down, had my dinner, went to bed normal time, woke up today with 100 sleep score. I'm like, this is mind blowing. Like that, to me, that's just evidence I need to be meditating way more often.
Yeah. And if you're sleeping well, that's like a secret weapon. It's like a superpower. Like you do everything better. Everything goes better, right? Relationships go better. Interactions go better. You're more present. You're more focused. You're more disciplined. You're more likely to do the other things that will make you show up better, whether it's working out or a sales presentation, anything.
Sleep is everything. I'll share a little story about sleep. So I've got a little methodology I ask my clients to check in on once a month. And any of your listeners can do this. It's called Take Your Meds. And your meds being meditation, exercise, diet, and sleep. Simply once a month, go 1 to 5. How am I doing in each of those areas? You know, meditation, doing it every day, great 5. Exercise, you know what, been great, 4. Diet, it's probably not been so good. Eating on the run, probably a 2. Sleep, I've got kids under 2 years of age. It's pretty full on, so it's maybe a 3. What's the lowest ranking one? Focus on that for the next month and see how you can improve that. So the sleep component to me is everything. So a friend of mine, Alex, is the performance coach for George Russell. So for those that are listening that enjoy Formula One, he just won the Grand Prix in Singapore. He races for Team Mercedes. So I said, what are the 2-3 things you measure to help George perform better at his job? And look at it through the lens of, I'm sure it would help us everyday people too. So the 2 things. The first thing was happiness. They measure his happiness. And I thought, what? A multi-billion dollar, you know, industry, fast as you can, crazy go, it's all glam and red carpets. Happiness. I was like, tell me about that. Well, when George is happy, the rest of us get to perform better. Because when he's grumpy, we all feel it. So we work on what is it that makes him happy? Time with his partner, time away from the cameras. That increases his happiness and therefore his performance improves. Secondly, and quite logically, they measure his sleep. So they use a Garmin and they use an Oura ring to measure his quality of sleep and his depth of sleep. When he sleeps better, guess what? You know the reaction thing where they had to pop out the lights to see how quick they're reacting? That goes up significantly. He improves better in terms of his times on the course. So they said they do simple things. They bring the same pillow for him to every race. They even bring the same king-size mattress to every race. Now we're talking Miami, Abu Dhabi, Melbourne, Australia. They're transporting these things because they know his sleep is damn important. So it's no different for you or I. None of us that are listening, maybe 1 or 2, I don't know, but most of us don't race Formula One cars. And so it's about us performing in our jobs, with our families, with the people that matter most. Sleep is everything.
So you mentioned this guy, George. He's got a performance coach. Why does George need a performance coach? I mean, he's one of the best in the world. I say this a little bit tongue in cheek because I think a lot of men feel like they should be able to do it alone, be able to go it alone. You know, this guy, George, or pick the George of whatever sport for the listener, whatever sport that, that you want. Who's your George, right? Who's the guy who's world class at it? And why does that person need a coach? I mean, they're world class, so they should be good, right?
100%. There's a direct correlation between why they're world class and the fact they've got coaches. So Pavarotti had a singing coach. You know what I mean? Tony Robbins, arguably one of the best keynote speakers on the planet, has a speaking coach, Roger Love. I was hanging out with Aryna Sabalenka earlier in the year at the Australian Open. So world number one in tennis has been for, 100 weeks in a row. She has a strength and conditioning coach. She has a mental skills coach. She has a swing coach. All these different coaches. Why? People who are great understand that, you know, success leaves clues. The people who are the greatest at what they do get mentorship. They get coaches. And some people are paying literally millions or hundreds of thousands of dollars for coaches. Others get themselves a board of directors for their life. And it's people they admire that are way better than them at finance, spirituality, something in their industry, but they get mentorship with them and it could be in a non-monetary fashion. But I think having a mentor and a coach is crucial if you want more fulfillment in life and better results.
Yeah. A good friend of mine, Ruben Gonzalez, who I've had on the podcast a couple of times, maybe three or four times actually now. He's a four-time Olympian in the luge and he wrote a book called The Shortcut. And we always say, hey, there's no shortcuts to success. There's no shortcuts in life. Well, there actually is. If you get a coach, that it will make the path straighter and shorter. And most people, I think, miss that. And I'll be honest, like if you were to ask me, like, what's the one piece of advice I would give myself 10 years ago or 20 years ago, I would say, I would get a coach, like find people who have already been there. And if you can't afford a coach, I mean, first of all, think of it, if the coach is going to help you make more money or grow your business or grow your career, there's an ROI there. But if it's something different and you don't want to invest the money, I mean, at least find somebody who's going to invest in you and spend time with you who's already figured it out. And, you know, you're only going to, you know, you kind of get what you pay for a lot of times. But, you know, finding that person who can help you discover your shortcut is so critical. It's just, you know, so like you said, James, success leaves clues.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And if you won't invest in yourself, why would anybody else invest in you? You know, why would anybody else believe in you or back you? Rewind 15 years. I wanted to grow, so I was reading like crazy, but I realized I was a bit stuck. So I was like, I need to get some coaching. But all I could afford was like $500-$600 for a course. Thought, well, I'll do that. Well, I did the course. I was radically obsessed with what they were telling me to do. And all of a sudden, fast forward 6-7 months, I've got an extra 10 grand in my bank account because I'm more valuable at my place of work. So the following year, I then get a $2,000 course that helps me then build my business. I'm like, okay, by the end of that year, I had another $50,000 on top of what I was earning. I'm like, okay, this is working. And so fast forward to now, I'm investing $35,000 to $40,000 with multiple coaches. Had you said that to James 15 years ago, you're going to invest $40,000, I would have, yeah, right, that's ridiculous. But now I know the ROI, just because I've done all these smaller tests over the last 15 years, the ROI on me investing in myself is usually 10x. So when I invested, I think it was 40K last week, I know in the next year, if I do the work, because this person I'm getting coached with is a legend at what they do, that will be close to $500,000 in terms of a return, if not more. And I think that's what we got to look for, is back yourself, find the right coach for you, take your time, don't be impulsive, do a bit of research, ask for some testimonials and case studies, but please invest in yourself. It's so crucial.
James, let's talk about failure. Failure on the path to success. You know, when you work with a client who has gone through a failure or experienced a failure, how do you help them process it? What are your thoughts with failure?
Well, we're all full of BS, right? Our belief systems are just like charging through our subconscious. So failure is important. I was working with a client yesterday afternoon. I said, what do you believe about failure? And it was all negative. It was all like, you've failed, you've let people down. And I said, okay, how could you look at failure as a positive thing? He says, oh, I can't, it's a failure. I was like, okay. Have you failed at something in the past and now you're better because of it? Well, yeah, here's, you give three or four examples. I say, okay, great. So failure is a great teacher, right? He went, yeah, I guess so. You know, failure is the road to success. So we started like reframing his belief systems as BS about failure. For me, you know, people go, you're a 7-time world champion. I'm like, yeah, but I'm a 14-time loser. Like, what do you mean? I was like, I lost the world championships way more times than I won it. That's just how life works. We're not going to be winning more than losing. Losing is what kind of dominates. But it's how we take the losing and take the learnings from it and apply it to our next thing. So for me, biggest failure, arguably in life, was divorce. You know, getting into marriage and doing proposal, like, there's no way I'm picturing divorce. None of us want that. It's painful. It's horrible. But now looking back on that, like, oh, there was a hell of a lot of growth. So I had a mentor who was 80 years of age, and he'd done a lot of Zen training in his days, NLP practitioner, International Hall of Fame karate, like, just an amazing guy. So we're out for a walk, and he says, James, 4 months ago when we chatted, you were married. Now you're not. What was your role in that? And I was like, whoa, Renzi, that's a big question, man. And my dad had not asked me that. My brother had not asked me that. My best friends were too afraid to say, what was your role in that? But Renzi, my mentor, he cared deeply and he wasn't afraid to be candid. James, what was your role in that? What responsibility do you take? What are you going to do to change? I was like, whoa, this is so powerful. And so for me, a lot of positive learnings came out of that around what do I value? What do I want marriage to look like? What matters to me? What pace do I want my next relationship to move at? How do I want to show up? And how do I focus on what's most important and not just be win, 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 work, 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 world champion? There's more to life than that. So in my experience, failures have been very helpful. They've been painful at the time, but so helpful. And they're only helpful when I've stopped to reflect. Journal, you know, mentorship, whatever it might be, but get out of your head and onto the page and learn from those mistakes.
Yeah, I interviewed Tim Ferriss for the podcast and he said, you know, failure in and of itself isn't valuable. It's the learning that takes place from failure. Like, you actually have to go back to what we were talking about earlier, that pause, that reflection, the asking of questions, the working with a coach, working with a mentor to help you process and actually learn from the failure. Because, you know, you talk to a lot of people about failure and they say, well, you know, or if their kids fail or if their colleague fails, it's easy to say, hey, no, you're going to learn from it. You're going to be better from it. This is a growth opportunity. But when we fail, like when I fail, it doesn't feel like that. It doesn't feel like a growth opportunity. It sucks, you know? So we have to take our own medicine. We have to, and it's easier to do that with a coach or with somebody outside of us who can help us, you know, see the things that we can't see from that failure. But I had a client recently, he's in sales and they get a few sales per year for this company. And that's what drives their revenue. I mean, very, very large sort of multi-million-dollar sales. And he had one that was sort of, you know, a real opportunity that he feels like he should have had a big fish, a whale that he should have landed. And he didn't. And he showed up on the call just, you know, you could just see it on his face. You know, he was trying to hide it, but, you know, he was feeling the pain from that and just really deflated. And I walked him through an exercise. I actually have a written exercise. It's called a success through failure written exercise. And we identified, okay, like you said, what was my role in it? You know, what I have done differently? What did I learn? How am I better off for having failed? Like, how am I actually better? Certainly, okay, we know that, you know, the commission's not coming in, the whatever, the business, the, like, whatever, tough conversation with the boss. Like, but how am I, what are the ways I'm actually better off for this? And when you do that, when you process that, that's how you actually grow from failure. Like in athletics, we have, like you're watching film, right? You break down film. Oh yeah, I missed that block, or I did something wrong there. Then we grow, we get better from it. But if we're not doing that out here where, James, you and I live, and for the listener where you live, if you're not doing that, failure just beats you down and just grows that little voice of self-doubt that every one of us have, even the highest performers in the world, they have it too. But then you go back to George, they have a performance coach. They have somebody saying, okay, how do we grow from this? Let's look at all your successes. Let's look at what we learned from this. And if we don't do that, we're just leaving too much on the table.
100% agree. really do. It's really well put. And you're either doing one of two things. And the listener right now is doing one of these two things. You're either self-beating or self-building. And if you continue to self-beat, like, you're going to have a lot of self-doubt. You're not going to take the risks. You're not going to step outside your comfort zone. You've got to be a self-builder and talk about the things that you are good at. I run an annual event, and I ask everyone to get their phones out and text 8 people that they respect and care for. Say, hey, I'm at a personal growth summit around leadership. What's one trait in me that you would love to extract and add into your own life? And the amount of tears I get from recipients going, like, you know, love, obsession, discipline, like the things, the feedback they get from people is phenomenal. That's a self-building tool. We need to spend more time loving ourselves, and not from this egotistical, I love myself, but actually love who you are and love your strengths. The greatest people I've worked with, think of athletes, they don't double down on their weaknesses. They double down on their strengths, and they become world-class for that swing. They become world-class for that tackle. They just get really world-class at one thing. So stop worrying about what you're not. Start doubling down on what you are.
There's plenty of what you are not. You will thumb through social media later today and see all the things that you are not. But you got to remember who you are and what you do have.
Beautifully said.
James, for the listener who loves what they're hearing and they want to take action on what they learned here today, what's an action item that somebody can take, let's say, in the next 24 to 48 hours and start really putting into action what you've shared here today?
Look, I'd love to share with your listeners my high performance planner for free. And so they could just go to jjlachlan.com/planner. And if you could be able to put that in the show notes, that would be awesome. Lachlan's an odd one to spell. So they go there, they'll get that. They can use that on their iPad, their tablet, their computer. And it's the exact process that I take all of my clients through, whether they're athletes, CEOs, founders, busy parents. So that's one thing they could do. Also, they could come over and say hello on any of the socials. Just find me, James Lachlan, on LinkedIn, Instagram, etc. But I think the first step is just to get clear. What do I really want? Why do I want it so badly? And how much am I willing to suffer to get there?
For the listener, we'll have all those links in the action plan. You can go to James's website. You can go to jimharshajr.com/action. We'll have all those links. Make sure you take advantage of the free resource he just offered you to take action on what you learned here today. James works with world-class performers. He works with the leader of a country, and you get to learn from him. Take advantage of that. James, thank you so much for taking time to come on the show.
It's been a joy. Thanks a million, Jim.
Thank you.